Next case for argument, United States versus Dawson. Mr. Durkin.
I never heard of shooting a deer with a shotgun. That's pretty serious.
Oh, boy.
May it please the court, Mr. Jackson, Mr. Bindi. There's several lawyers arguing, so I'll try to be as quick as I can. Several months ago, I had the privilege of serving on a panel that was set up by the Notre Dame Law School at Mayor Brown, or not, at Sidley and Austin. And everybody, and I was in some pretty high company with the U.S. Attorney himself, one of his top assistants, Judge Kennelly, several other lawyers. And everybody got asked the question, what's the most troubling thing they've seen happen in the years they've been practicing? And I said, the war on drugs, when it came my turn. I said, because what's happened in my observation with the war on drugs in the 32 years I've been practicing here is that lying is now implicitly permitted in the federal court. And the second thing that's happened is there's a whole class of people that are going off to the penitentiary serving incredibly lengthy prison terms who have a legitimate beef about a system where, in reality, they shouldn't have a beef. And this case could be used as a textbook, I think, to teach a course on that if I wanted to. There are three issues I'd like to address here, all of which go, I think, to the heart of undermining confidence in the judicial system. You have an informant in this case, in one argument we raised.
Are you representing Durkin or Dawson? I mean Ingram or Dawson?
I represent Dawson, who got 30 years on this evidence. You have an informant who flat out lied about whether or not he was told he was not going to be prosecuted. He was confronted with testimony from another case where the agent, one of the agents on this very case, admitted that that's what he had told the informant because that's what he had been told by the U.S. Attorney's Office. And in response to the argument that we don't have to correct that, the government says to the court, and we cite it in our brief, let's not be confused here. There might have been agreements between our office and the DEA, but this man was not literally told that that decision had been made. And that's the kind of semantics.
Well, wait a second. What's wrong with that? If he didn't know that he was going to be treated well, it wouldn't affect his testimony, right?
Well, as we pointed out in our brief, that doesn't pass the smell test, I think.
I don't understand you.
Well, because this is a man, they continue to say.
Suppose the U.S. attorney says to himself, I really like this guy, Diaz. He's done tremendous work for us. I'm not going to prosecute him no matter what he does. But suppose he doesn't tell anybody that.
Well, but he did.
Diaz wouldn't be. Yeah, but no. You said that the government's argument was semantic. But if the government is correct that Diaz wasn't told, then it's a perfectly good argument, isn't it?
Well, except that I don't think that argument's correct, which was my point. Because Jeffrey Marin, the agent.
Your point was different. Your point seemed to be that even if he wasn't told, it wouldn't make any difference.
No,
if
well, that he, wasn't. I don't mean to say that. Right. What I'm suggesting is, in this case, the record is clear that Marin was told that that was the deal, and that Marin told the informant that. And there's corroboration that he knew that because he full well had lied with respect to this whole incident where he called in the police saying he'd been kidnapped when, in fact, he was having voluntary sex with these people. The government knew this guy stunk out loud. But the second issue, which I think is just as serious, you know, you've warned repeatedly that they should not be doing contingent fee agreements with informants. And nevertheless, this informant got not only 94,000, this is a guy who was looking at life in prison. And instead of getting life in prison, he gets a relative.
I don't think it's precise to call it a contingent fee for testimony. It's a bounty, right? It's a bounty.
Well, yeah,
he bounty. He recovers money for the government. He gets a share of it.
But he doesn't get
there's
that.
Nothing wrong with bounties, is there?
Well, I think there should be.
Really?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Bounty hunting? And
I think if you have concern about what's going on in the trial courts, you should be concerned about bounties being given to informants to lie in drug cases. And
no,
that's what's happening.
They're given the bounty to recover the money. They may or may not testify.
But it gives them the incentive to
lie.
That's
true of any bounty situation.
Well, you asked me whether I thought anybody...
Yeah, but the bounties aren't unconstitutional.
Of course they're not unconstitutional.
All right, so...
We're talking about confidence in the judicial system. We're talking about whether or not...
The government can use methods of investigation and proof and so on, which, as long as they're legal, the fact that they may be disreputable and undermine confidence in the judicial system or the Department of Justice, that's not our business, right?
I don't know that I can't imagine
we don't
more
have
important business that you would have, Judge.
Call. Oh, come on. We do not have the authority to reverse a conviction because we think that the government's conduct would undermine confidence in the legal system.
Well, that's what you
we
said.
We have to find a violation of law, right, to reverse?
That well,
has to
certainly,
be
but,
an
but
error
you...
of some sort, not just an atmospheric cloud.
Well, but what I'm suggesting is, in this case, you have a chance to do so because I think you can take that bounty and infer that that's exactly what was going on with respect to his testimony about whether he'd been promised anything.
When we looked at this before, because I think the doctrine you're relying on is outrageous government conduct, which, of course, this court rejected in 95. And so I want to get to the theory that you're premising this upon. Are you saying that you think it's time now for us to revisit this outrageous government conduct and make that a grounds? Is there anything else you have, Mr.
I would suggest that you should, but I think this case doesn't have to go that far because I think you can take the bounty and infer that that's what was creating the lying. But you also have a whole other problem, which I also think is based on lying by the informant, which is this whole authentication of the tapes. I know my
That's
time.
That's a separate point, but I've been sticking for a moment with the question of the bounty. This was explained to the jury, wasn't it?
Yes.
Yeah. So the jury could make a judgment. They might think this is, you know, this completely undermined Diaz's credibility and. Then they'd reject. Why would you want to exclude the evidence? You want to exclude evidence if a jury is perfectly capable of giving proper weight?
All I'm suggesting to you, Judge, is that things are out of hand in the district court.
That's too broad.
Well, I'm sorry that it's too broad.
You have to be more precise.
I'm being precise. If you look at this
basis for reversal.
If you look at this record, there are several bases for reversal, but the one is the lying that took place over whether he had a deal. And I think that's influenced by the contingent fee. I certainly concede you can't reverse just on the contingent fee. But when you take that and then you couple with that this outrageousness over the authenticity of the tapes, the only authentication was done, again, on the basis of the unbelievable testimony, in my opinion, of this informant who says, oh, yeah, those tapes contain everything that's in the conversation, even though trying to cross-examine
it. Well, when you say there's an authenticity problem, are you saying these are tapes of somebody else, not of Dawson?
No.
What's
I'm saying that there were... Well, one, there was no sufficient foundation laid because they'd never...
I don't understand you. Is it Dawson's voice on the tape or not?
Certainly it's Dawson's voice on the tape.
So that's self-authenticating, right?
That's self-authenticating perhaps for part of it, but that doesn't authenticate the whole tape. That may authenticate the fact that Dawson was there,
but that's not how you can authenticate this tape. Come on, forget authenticate. Your complaint is that there are omissions, right? There are erasures.
Which we proved, I believe.
Okay. Now, what is it you think was erased that would alter the significance of the parts that were recorded?
There were several questions that I asked the informant about in my cross-examination that he said that he didn't know. Those were based on information that my client had supplied me as to what he thought was on the tapes.
What would be a good example? Something that was erased that would help your client?
I believe one of the questions I asked was, could he have said something to the effect that, well, I'm not sure, or, well, we may have to wait, or something like that. There was an issue of entrapment here.
But he didn't wait. I mean, he went ahead with the money and everything, right? I don't understand.
My point is, if you want to just go ahead and say that that's okay, that from now on all we need is an informant. We don't even have to say that these every case in this circuit that I read about authentication, as much as you've expanded it and permitted them to do so, every case, at least somebody testified these had been kept in official custody. They didn't even say that.
It doesn't matter what custody there are. That's only important if you have a question about who was on the tape. You admit it's Dawson on the tape. The only question is the erasures. That has nothing to do with
my reading of your cases doesn't narrow
it. What difference does it make, the chain of custody? It's what is erased. That's what you're worried about. That's an unrelated concern.
Well, it seems to me.
What do you think they did?
If I were in
the chain of custody, what do you think happened?
What do I think happened?
Yes.
I think the tape was intentionally stopped and started.
Of course, but that's nothing to do with the chain of custody, right?
It's a question of does this tape.
You know there are erasures, right? You don't have to argue that.
The question is, does this tape purport to be a true and accurate rendition of the entire conversation?
And the answer
doesn't.
Is no, because there are erasures, right?
Right.
So the only question is, what's the significance of the erasures?
I understand that, but the significance is, are you just going to let them put on a post up in the witness stand, an informant who can simply say, yeah, I don't remember when I listened to these, I don't remember when I compared them, I didn't initial anything at all, but these are what they say, even though he says he has no independent recollection as he sits there as to what the conversation actually was. So what you're left with is just what the tape is. If that's okay with you, that's
weren't the tapes in the possession of custody of the defense at one point?
No. No.
Did they ask for the tapes?
We asked for them, and I believe we were given copies, or they were our expert had to go to their lab, and he reviewed them there. There was dialogue about that happening, but that never occurred.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Durkin. Mr. Morris?
Good morning. May it please the court, I'm Joseph Morris. I also represent Pierre Dawson. And under the time-sharing arrangements that counsel have, I think I have 4 minutes and a couple of minutes reserved for rebuttal. I've been asked by Mr. Dawson to address the commerce power questions that are...
It's such a loser.
Well, I hope not, Your Honor, and I strongly urge you to reconsider that dismissal of these issues out of hand in light of, well, not only... Of the decisions of the Supreme Court in the last 10 years, but of the fact that in the last 30 years there's really been no serious revisitation of the purported legislative findings by Congress in the Controlled Substances Act that seem to mean that any contact with
the traffic in drugs is clearly interstate and indeed international and therefore regulable by Congress, right? What else is there?
The traffic in drugs that is interstate and is international is clearly regulable by Congress. The question is any particular instance of possession, trafficking, dealing, possession, relationship with drugs in commerce or affecting commerce?
Well, it's an economic activity. That much is clear, is it not?
Well, I'm not certain that it's clear.
Well,
it can't be assumed to be clear. I'm sorry?
I say it involves buying and selling something, does it not?
Well, we have a line of cases involving... child pornography, where there's an attempt to connect the possession or sharing of child pornography with instrumentalities like photographic paper and computer components that obviously were made and manufactured and distributed in interstate commerce, and that has been held not to be sufficient.
That's not like this case, right?
Well, I think
the cocaine itself is traveling.
I think the problem here is that we don't know.
Commerce. Oh, you think the cocaine is grown here? Here in Chicago, and
or
where do you think cocaine comes from?
Or confected in a laboratory?
Infected? Synthesized cocaine?
I don't know. And neither do you, Your Honor, on the facts of this case, because the government never had
to
plead or prove.
You want to make an issue as to whether this cocaine is natural, comes from coca leaves, or was made in a laboratory in Chicago?
I want to make an issue of the fact that Congress seems to have said, and the courts for 30 years seem to be letting it say, that the government in a case that has no connection with federal law other than the commerce power never has even to plead, let alone prove, that the conduct that's an issue in the case has any effect upon or presence in interstate or foreign commerce. And that's the situation in this case. We don't know because it was never pleaded or proved. And that's not a, I don't think that is an automatic
and
loser.
So, yeah, just like you said, it's been 30 years of precedent that you're fighting against. What's the rationale, or on what basis would you have us overrule 30 years of precedent?
Well, I don't think that the precedents are necessarily all that persuasive. But let's look at what's going on in the Supreme Court right now in the Raich case.
Look, why don't you just reserve this issue and you can go to the Supreme Court? I mean, obviously, we're not going to overrule 100 years of cases involving the federal criminal power. I mean, next would be argument: bank robberies are not in commerce either, right?
Well, Your Honor, I implore this court and this panel.
Are bank robberies, are they within the federal criminal power?
They certainly can be, of course.
Can be.
Yes.
But on your view, right, there'd have to be evidence that the particular, I mean, if you go into a bank and rob the bank and you take the cash out of the teller's drawer, why wouldn't you regard that as just a local transaction?
It can be a local
transaction. Yes, of course, but that's why bank robbery is even older than drug crime. So you're asking us to upend the whole understanding of what the scope of the federal criminal power. That's ridiculous.
No, I'm not asking you to upend the whole understanding.
You're saying that a simple bank robbery where you just take cash from the teller's drawer is not within the federal criminal power.
I'm asking you
Aren't
to do...
Aren't you saying that?
I'm asking you to
Are
do
you an, saying that?
No, I'm not.
Well,
how
is that distinguishable from the cocaine?
What I'm asking you to do in
how
a,
is that distinguishable from cocaine?
What I'm asking you to do in a cocaine case is to do what you do in a pornography case, or what you do in a RICO case, or what you do in a Vicar case, or what you do in a Hobbs Act case.
Why not in a bank robbery case?
Plead and prove the nexus to commerce.
Precisely.
Right.
But that's why I'm saying you want to throw out all the bank robbery cases also. Because in none of those cases does the government try to prove that somehow robbing, $1,000 from a teller's drawer will have an effect on interstate commerce.
Well, you know, the difference between a bank and a drugstore is it may be an address and the fact that the one deals only in money and credit and the other deals in money and all kinds of commodities. And they both have cash drawers. And if someone walks into one and steals cash out of the cash drawer, and one walks into another and steals cash out of the cash drawer, we may or may not have different questions as to whether or not interstate commerce has been affected. What we don't know under a drug case, and to answer Judge Williams' question about why I think it's appropriate at this time for this court to open up this question, is what happened in the Ninth Circuit in the Raich case, where the court suddenly begins looking at the question of whether or not the statute is constitutional to the conduct as applied to that conduct.
Don't we have to do away with Wickard versus Filburn to open up this Pandora's box?
Well, the Ninth Circuit didn't have to do that because Wickard versus Filburn involved an inquiry as to whether or not there was an effect or an impact upon interstate commerce.
No.
Yeah, sure it did.
No, it didn't.
And the Supreme
what
Court
it said was
by refraining.
Let me finish.
Sure.
As a matter of theory, local consumption, a farmer's consumption of his own wheat, as a matter of theory, could affect the price of wheat. There was no factual inquiry into whether this farmer's consumption of wheat had any effect on the price of wheat. Obviously, it didn't. It was too small. And that's the same as robbing the teller's drawer or a particular drug transaction. You don't have to prove that it actually has an effect on commerce.
Well, Your Honor knows that certainly I'm a critic of the theory of Wickard versus Filburn.
Yeah, but you're in the wrong place, right?
Well,
you can be a critic. We can't say Mr. Morris persuaded us that the Supreme Court's decision in Wickard versus Filburn, expressly reaffirmed in the Lopez decision, is unsound.
But
and
I can
therefore, using our powers as a lower federal court, we overrule the Supreme Court.
No, but, Your Honor, I don't believe you need to do that. I think you can do what the Ninth Circuit did in Veitch and say, you know what there needs to be under the Controlled Substance Act? There needs to be an as-applied analysis, and we can't have an as-applied analysis if we excuse the government in every single case from pleading a nexus to interstate commerce.
What you would want in Wickard versus Filmer.
I would want that in Wickard versus Filburn, but I don't think I need
to. The logic of Wickard and Filburn is inconsistent with your submission to us.
Yes, that's true.
You're in the wrong court. We cannot overrule Wickard versus Filburn.
You can smile on my disagreement with it, and I hope you will.
I don't think so. Thank you, Mr. Morris. Mr. Weinberg?
So we should cite your smile when we rule in your favor as the authority, right?
May it please the court, my name is Steven Weinberg, and I represent Alfonso Ingram. And in this case, Judge, we feel that an error was made during jury deliberations. We feel that the jury sent out a note during deliberations, and it stated, quoting, regarding count one, given the wording, can one defendant be separate from the other? And given the wording, which indeed is Pierre Dawson and Alfonso Ingram did conspire, it's
the verb used in that question was can, right?
Correct.
Is it possible?
Yes.
And the answer was, yes, it's possible. Now, what's the matter with that?
Your Honor, we feel that that is
directly responsive to the question.
We feel that that is a misstatement of the law by not advising the jury that it is mandatory.
Can't the judge just answer the question?
Well, certainly the judge can answer the question, but
You wanted to make a broader statement that's not responsive to the question.
Well, we wanted her to make a statement that we felt...
I thought you didn't want her to make any statement at all.
No, we wanted her... Our response to the judge was, you have the instructions, you have the evidence, continue deliberating.
Right, well, that's no response
there
at
was,
all.
There was...
You didn't want her to amplify the instructions.
Well, we didn't want her necessarily to give them a supplemental instruction, but if she did give them a supplemental instruction, we wanted it to...
You didn't want her to give a supplemental instruction.
Well, at the time, we objected to the answer
right,
that she gave.
But you didn't want any supplemental instruction.
Right. We wanted her to tell them that they had the instructions and to continue.
Well, how did the supplemental instruction she gave hurt your client?
Well, we feel that it hurt our client, Your Honor, because we feel that based on their verdict and based on their question, that they felt that they could only convict Mr. Dawson, where we feel the evidence was overwhelming, by convicting Mr. Ingram, because those were the only two co-conspirators charged in this indictment. And they came back. Mr. Dawson was convicted of conspiracy to possess with intent to distribute more than 5 kilos, but he was acquitted of attempted possession.
Well, had the jury been told that Dawson and Ingram were the only conspirators?
They were told that Dawson and Ingram, and there was
they're the only defendants, but they're the only conspirators?
Well, there was an issue about whether or not they should be told that you cannot conspire with Diaz, because he was the only other party in the case, and certainly he was a government agent, so he was not able to be a co-conspirator. So the jury was never told, it wasn't clarified for them that they were unable to consider Diaz as a co-conspirator, and based on their not guilty finding, we feel that they were confused by the judge's answer to the question by not telling them that they must consider each defendant separately.
Now, I understand that you didn't want the court to give any instruction, to just say, rely on the instructions you've been given. But when the court indicated its intention to say, to answer the question, yes, did anybody on the defense side say, and could you reread that initial instruction that makes that clear?
What happened, Your Honor, was the court said, I'm just going to answer yes, and literally got up off the bench and left. We were off the record. It wasn't until the next day that we realized.
So you didn't have you couldn't stop the court and say, Judge, if you're going to answer it that way, then can you also reread to them the other instruction that was given earlier?
Whether we could or couldn't, we didn't. I don't know how we physically would have, but it was a situation where the court was then in recess, and as soon as we found out...
And it was not on the record, this discussion with the court. The court reporter wasn't brought out or anything.
Well, that was the next day when we found out that the answer was not yes, as the judge had instructed us, and the judge, in fact, gave a different answer, which then we had the court reporter and we all objected, and that's how the issue was preserved.
And there was no request that the court reporter be present when this question came out from the jury to put it on the record? I mean,
that was on the record. There was a court reporter when the judge read us the question, and there was a significant discussion about how to answer it.
Right. And then the judge said she was going to answer yes. That's what I'm trying to
right.
get at. So you were on the record.
Yes, we were on the record.
Clear to me.
Yes.
All right.
I'm sorry.
So, okay.
And then the judge.
I just don't understand why you couldn't have asked the court, even though she's getting up to leave the bench, and say, Judge, if you're going to do that, why can't you do this other instruction?
As I said, maybe we could have. We just didn't.
Okay.
It was in the heat of the courtroom. With that, Judge, we feel, and I might feel differently had Mr. Ingram been convicted on both offenses, but since he was actually acquitted of the object of this particular conspiracy, we feel that it was the jury question and the note and the answer that did confuse them. I see that the light is on, and if I could reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you very much, Mr. Weinberg. Mr. Jackson?
May it please the court, George Jackson, representing the government. Your Honor, I'd like to start, if I may, first with the Diaz argument about whether he'd be prosecuted. As the lower court found, Mr. Diaz testified and he was cross-examined repeatedly about whether he would be prosecuted, and he testified, look, I was told that if I testify, continue to cooperate, and testify truthfully, that I won't be prosecuted. So he responded directly to the questions that were posed. And as the court explained, his response was a true and accurate response because, in fact, he did not know whether he would be prosecuted because he didn't know whether the person who had to make the determination whether he was telling the truth would find whether he had, in fact, told the truth. On the issue of the bounty.
Yeah, I really want you to spend some time on this because this court has said this is not a good practice. We frown on this practice, and then it's still this practice continues. And in terms of, you know, the Estrada, it was really only saved because there was overwhelming evidence of the defendant's drug involvement. I mean, so we never got to that outrageous government misconduct. But what he got in the end wasn't that dependent upon the outcome of the case in terms of what his deal was, getting that percentage.
We start with the position, Your Honor, that it's our position that there is equally as well overwhelming evidence in both these cases based upon the taped evidence and the testimony of Mr. Diaz. And what we have here is that with respect to the monies that he received, it's in twofold. The first is more in line with the bounty, and that's the initial money that he got, regardless of whether anyone is convicted, regardless of whether anything is forfeit. He was paid a sum. That sum was roughly over $100,000. The second part, and we find no problem with that, Your Honor, nor is there any history of the case history finding problem with paying a person a part of the bounty, a part of the proceeds that they have, through their assistance, helped the government to get off the street.
This is when he received up to 20% of any money seized and forfeited as a result of his cooperation?
That's the second portion, the 20% of the money seized and forfeit. Now, understand that in this particular case, Mr. Diaz said that he didn't really understand the notion of forfeitures. He didn't understand that anyone had to be convicted in order for him to receive the funds. Therefore, in this particular case, we don't have any motivation on his part to try to ensure that these defendants are convicted in order to receive the funds. His understanding was, once we get the funds, I may get up to 20% of it. And I think that tempers the any tendency to want to revisit this issue of outrageous government misconduct.
And that assumes that the court will assume that he was truthful when he answered those questions.
That does, Judge. That does. And one could assume on that same level that if the court thought that he was untruthful, that the court would have given a different verdict on that score. But the court did not express any apprehension about the credibility of Mr. Diaz when he testified. And
so
in fact,
you don't, so you don't view this as being problematic in any way, and the fact that it could undermine confidence in the criminal justice system when this kind of deal is cut.
Your Honor, not only do I consider it not to be problematic, but I think that in a large part that it may be essential, because who else is there to get us inside drug deals as they operate but a drug dealer? Part of the motive in their cooperation is some level of reward, and the level of reward is the money you get off the street to us. We will give you a percentage of that. That's what happened in this case. That's one of the things that we use. It's a tool in our arsenal in fighting the war on drugs, and I think that it's a necessary tool, Your Honor, and it's not one that undermines the confidence of the judicial system, because the fact of his having received funds, that's shared with the jury. The jury has the opportunity to consider and did consider all of that, and indeed, Mr. Diaz was cross-examined extensively about the monies that he received. The jury heard all of that cross-examination, so I think that it does not undermine the confidence in the judicial system by allowing these types of rewards or bounties, these types of remunerations or payments. The tape authentication. There is no issue that that the individuals who were on the tapes were defended. Dawson and defendant Ingram.
But what about the stop and starts and the gaps in the tape?
There was, at most, Your Honor, there was evidence of those things. Now, those are the types of things that are inherent in the type of clandestine undercover recordings that we make. When one is recording with a device that's sends out a signal to a receiver, then the recorder activates based upon the receiver. Those types of things are unavoidable. Here, there is no evidence as to the substance of anything that was missing, and I like to go in that direction with Judge Posner, as he explained earlier, that there's no evidence that if there was anything missing, that those are things that would have benefited the defendants. And indeed, it's likely to suggest that anything that was missing, Your Honor, were consistent with the things that were already on the tape. And the things that were already on the tape were the defendants talking about drug transactions, talking about cocaine, talking about hydraulic lifts, and those types of things. On the supplemental jury instruction.
Well, let's get back. There was this chain of custody argument. Do you think that chain of custody need to be proven?
No, Judge. Not where we have. We can have authentication, as I think both sides acknowledge, either through chain of custody or through eyewitness testimony of a participant to the conversation. In this instance, we chose the latter. We chose to authenticate the tapes through the testimony of participants to the conversation, that being Mr. Diaz and Task Force Officer Dominguez. As a result of that, we don't need the chain of custody. And chain of custody actually would add nothing. It would protect nothing against what the defendants are now complaining about, in fact. They're complaining about that there are erasures, or that there are gaps and starts and stops. Well, having provided chain of custody would not in any way have alleviated that concern. There could still very well be gaps and starts and stops, and in fact there would have been, because that's the way these recordings were. So chain of custody is not required, and in fact, in application, it would not have advanced, or it would not have prevented that which the defendants now complain about.
Could I ask a question about Ingram's sentencing? So you agree that as far as, whether he's entitled to a minor role discount, that has to go back for a hearing?
No, Judge.
No?
No. His minor role is, the court said, In fact, Judge Buckelow found that he could very well have been the leader.
No, I understand, but you are, but you've agreed to a Palladino remand, right? Wouldn't that be one of the issues?
No, Judge. I think that the Palladino remand is will be limited to once you have the guidelines as they are, which you have given the same sentence. And I think that would be the limitation of it. It's not one to recalculate the guidelines, because if the guidelines apply.
All right, then let me change my question. So what was this finding really solid enough to stand up? Because wasn't Aubrey's testimony, you know, really, really shaky?
Well, no. Actually, Your Honor,
she placed him in Memphis when he was in Las Vegas, and yeah, go ahead.
Well, deferring to the credibility determinations of the district court, as this court will do in this instance, the district court found specifically. I found, she said that she being the district court, found Ms. Aubrey to be credible, that she testified credibly. This is even given the claims that have been made at that point by defense counsel that, well, we have him in Las Vegas, at or appearing to be in Las Vegas at a portion or around the time that this incident happened. But that doesn't mean, Your Honor, that he could not have jumped on a flight. And there are numerous flights from Las Vegas to Chicago, excuse me, to Memphis, and intended to arrive at Memphis at that time. We don't know that. We don't know whether he found out that she had been arrested or had been accosted. We know that, based upon the taped evidence, that at least Mr. Dawson knew about the arrest, because he talked about the arrest, and he talked about the fact that he got the call late at night from his attorney at the time, explained to him about the, as Mr. Dawson put it, the broad, in reference to Ms. Aubrey, that Ms. Aubrey had been arrested. So the fact of the arrest had taken place. The defendant was in, excuse me, Ingram was purportedly in Vegas at the time, but he could have arrived in Memphis in sufficient time to conduct a drug transaction.
Going back for a second to supplemental instruction, so what I understood Mr. Weinberg to be saying was that the jury might have thought, they obviously wanted to convict Dawson of conspiracy, but maybe they thought that they couldn't convict Dawson unless they also convicted Ingram, because then there wouldn't be a conspiracy.
Well, two things, if I may, Judge, in direct response to your question. That's somewhat troubling in the sense that he's saying necessarily the jury found that Dawson at least conspired with Ingram. Well, if Dawson conspired with Ingram, such that you're trying to convict him for having conspired with Ingram, then Ingram conspired with Dawson. They're both guilty. The second point that I'd like to draw from this is that we can't glean anything from the fact of the verdict that the jury provided. And indeed, it's somewhat surprising when I heard counsel say that he might feel differently if Mr. Ingram had been convicted on both counts. Well, what that suggests is that the only reason that there is an issue with respect to this supplemental instruction now is because Mr. Ingram was convicted on one count and not the other. If he had been convicted on both counts, then by suggestion, we wouldn't be here. But we can't use a conviction or a lack of a conviction or delve into why the jury decided as it did in order to make a determination now on whether the jury instructions were adequate, were sufficient and proper. We submit that they were proper. It was, as Judge Cuddy said, the question was simple, which was, can we give them separate consideration? And the judge said, yes.
Would have been better to add, and in fact, you must, to that response.
It would have been redundant in that two separate instructions they were told that they must give separate consideration.
But on the conspiracy, too? I mean, You really, I mean, what you said before, if there are only two possible conspirators, Dawson and Ingram, and Diaz can't be a conspirator, then you can't really, on the conspiracy count, you can't consider them separately, can you?
Well,
they're either both guilty of conspiracy or neither. Is that right? Or are there other conspirators floating around here that...
Yes, there were, Judge. There were others that were charged in the indictment,
the jury,
and others.
So could the jury have found that Dawson conspired with other people but not with Ingram?
And that's the argument that we advance.
So you're saying when the judge said it is... You can treat them separately. That meant they could actually have convicted Dawson without convicting Ingram.
Exactly, Your Honor. The indictment charges and others, and in fact, we presented evidence that where others are involved. Indeed, even in the briefs of the defendants, they make reference to the white guy, as they put it, the other guy who came and received drugs. There's talk about an individual by the name of Tibu, T-I-B-U-E, T-I-B-U, as well as others that were involved. So the notion that they only can convict the only way to convict is to also convict Ingram is a misnomer. It's not accurate.
Well, if the court didn't say in response to the question, and you must, wouldn't it have been better for the court to review those instructions that were already there? Because obviously the jury was a little confused about it. So to reread those instructions that talked about separate consideration would have been better.
Judge,
clear.
Then that's a balancing test. Because then one can argue is, well, now you highlight certain instructions over other instructions.
Yeah, but only that, but the question only had, that would be reading all the instructions that related to that issue. I agree with you if that implicated lots of other instructions, but the only instructions that were implicated were those dealing with the separate consideration, right?
And those instructions were still,
right.
that's
as
correct.
As it related to that question.
As we understood the question to be.
Mm-hmm.
One of the problems that we went back and forth on was what exactly were they asking, which is why the government was opposed to merely to the court responding with a simple question of yes, a response of yes. Because you may be saying yes to a question that you understand that they're asking, but they in fact are not asking. So, Judge Williams, I understand the nature of your question, but I'm not sure that picking out certain instructions would have necessarily answered the question that the jury may have had in mind, although it would have answered the questions that I had in mind having read the instruction, or the question that the judge had in mind having read the instruction. Instead, the better precision we suggested was to answer the question with as much precision as possible, which was, can you do this? Yes, it's possible. You can do this.
There's a suggestion in your brief, I guess, that Ingram may be the big boss here. Is there any basis for that other than the fact that he arrived with the money?
It's a matter of interpretation of the facts and how things unfolded. One can argue that the person who's really in charge will minimize their actual participation with the drug lords or the source of the money.
Mm-hmm.
So one could conclude that when it was time to do the deal, at the appropriate time, at the appropriate location, the individual who showed up was Ingram. But more important than that, if you look at how things transpired, he showed up, and he didn't really show up, but he took an assertive position. He was the one who told, in the first meeting, he told Ingram, we're going to do this deal. Well, worse than that, you can bet we're going to do this. At the actual drug transaction, it's Dawson who's counting out the funds. With Ingram there, Diaz said, you know, you don't have to do that, or worse to that effect. It was then Ingram who asserted his authority position and said, no, I want you to know that it's all there, or worse to that effect. So in totality, viewing that type of activity, one can surmise that he was the bigwig, so to speak, that he was a drug kingpin.
The real kingpin, of course, has so minimized his participation that he hasn't been caught yet.
I'm sorry, Judge, I didn't hear.
Well, presumably above Ingram is the person who so effectively minimizes his participation that he's not caught, right?
Which is why we have to have bounties and, right, and those types of things, so that we can ultimately get up to those individuals.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Judge.
Jackson. So, is there rebuttal time for any of the... No? They've all run out of time? Well, Mr. Durkin, you want a minute? Would you like a minute? We'll even give Mr. Morris a minute.
Oh, Your Honor, since I have not obliged to sort of by high time, I'd like to use
it. Oh, okay. Fine. Well...
Will the Court please note that Mr. Dawson preserved his commerce power issue?
Of course. We know you haven't abandoned it, Mr. Morris.
I just wanted to address Judge Williams' question to Mr. Jackson about the bounty. The record, as I understand it, made clear that there were two separate payments of money. There was $90-some thousand, or perhaps $100. Mr. Jackson said $100. I thought it was in the 90s, of what they typically call expenses and reimbursement and money for information. That's the stuff that they give informants that the Bureau has or the DEA has available to pay these people. What you criticize in Estrada is the opposite. It's the second end of the money. It's the contingent fee agreement. And that, and the evidence in this case, was that he stood to make $80-some thousand. And it, one of the problems, it seems to me, is that whenever you warn the government that something's wrong, they don't get it unless you do something. And that's what I think you have to do. And I mean that respectfully. This is going on. You get people like this in these cases, and that's what's happening. And I don't mean to beat the dead horse, but I think it is an awful practice, and it ought to be stopped. And there's only one way you can stop it, and that is finally reverse a conviction, because they just don't get the message. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Durkin. Mr. Weinberg, do you have anything further?
I would simply say that in this case, we have to look at the lack of conviction on the second count in order to decide whether or not the jury was confused. That is something that must happen, because that is what did happen, is they found Mr. Ingram not guilty of the object of this conspiracy. Furthermore, Your Honors, there is no way, there's nothing in this record that would allow the jury to believe that there was anyone other than Mr. Ingram who could have conspired with Mr. Dawson on this particular drug deal. Furthermore, there is nothing in the record that would show credence that Mr. Ingram, not only is he not the kingpin, but there's no evidence that he brought the money to the deal. He was present at the time the deal went down, but in terms of him showing up and bringing money to that deal, which is the impetus that would make the deal continue, there's no evidence of that. In fact, Mr. Diaz actually testified that this deal would have gone down with or without Ingram. All the negotiations with Diaz were with Dawson, and Ingram's name was not mentioned, nor did he ever arrive on the scene until the day of the deal.
So none of these unnamed conspirators were referred to with respect to that transaction?
Correct, Your Honor. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And were all of you appointed to represent you? You're all retained?
Yes,
all right. So.